today a little bit about the fundamental observational cosmology. How do we actually determine from astronomy, from observations, the mass density of the universe? That's a topic that I've been working on for a while. And I just want to share with you, so when you hear all the beautiful theoretical work on trying to understand dark matter, that you get the connection, what do the observations tell us? And if we have time, I'll also try to get to show you a little bit of the observational results that we have from which we infer the existence of dark energy. Those are the two most fundamental and exciting mysteries in cosmology. But before I get started, just wanted to get a feel. I understand that most of you come from theoretical physics background. How many of you have taken an astronomy course or observational cosmology course? Okay. How many of you know what flat rotation curves are? Okay, fine. So I will not cover some of the basics in detail, but if anybody has questions as we go along, I will not go speedingly fast. So as we go along, please feel free to interrupt and ask questions, because some of you know the material, some of you do not. Okay, so let's get started. So first of all, I think, obviously, you are here and you're interested in cosmology, so we don't have to justify to you why it's important to weigh the universe and to understand how much matter exists there. I mean, that's just probably the most fundamental question that we can ask. What's out there in the universe? How much does it weigh? But we want to understand the question, which we now we think we understand, is the dark matter, and also where is it located? And I'll try to show you results also to that question. How is the dark matter distributed? But I want to emphasize or clarify that when we talk about dark matter, the usual interpretation is the non-baryonic dark matter. And you heard from Neil a beautiful introduction to that. But there is also dark matter. If you just look at the name, dark matter, there is just regular baryonic matter that is dark, that we don't count when we look at some of the light matter. When I gave a talk at some point and talked about dark matter, somebody raised their hand and asked, will you consider the moon as dark matter? And the answer is yes. By definition, moons and planets and rocks and those types of things are dark matter. They don't shine by their own light. We don't integrate it in the light that we observe with a telescope. So they are part of dark matter. So we really have two basic types of dark matter. One is just regular baryonic dark matter. That's not a big deal. We know how many baryons we have in the universe. We know that some stuff doesn't shine. If you have lots of rocks out there, they don't shine. So that's the part of dark matter that is baryonic, and that's usually not what cosmologists or physicists refer to when they talk about dark matter. What they refer to as dark matter is the other type of dark matter, which is the non-baryonic dark matter. But I want you to understand that really there are these two very different types. Now, why do we think there is non-baryonic dark matter? What's the main reason, observationally? Why do we think, why don't we think that everything is baryonic? Even all the dark matter, let me measure, why isn't it all baryonic? What's the main one observational reason? Anyone? What's the main observational reason that if we measure omega matter to be 20-25%, why couldn't it all be baryonic? Our life will be much easier. That's one reason, that's one recent reason, that's very good. But we know that more basically for several decades, and I think Neil touched upon it, from BBN, from Big Bang Nucleosynthesis. So all the modeling of Big Bang Nucleosynthesis to tell us how many atoms of hydrogen and helium and lithium and deuterium can exist today depends very strongly on how many baryons existed in the universe then and of course today. It depends critically important on how many baryons. If you had more baryons than some amount, we'll find much less deuterium because deuterium will be destroyed by the other baryons, or we'll have much more helium. All the light element abundances depend on how many baryons exist. And that was already worked out 30, 40 years ago. And many people have worked on it and tried to modify it, tried very hard to see, can we change it so all the dark matter that we measure will be baryonic, and they can't. And they find that the only thing that fits the data, the observed light element abundances, is if the omega matter in baryons is 0.04. Everybody knows what omega matter means? The notation? Okay, I'll come to that. But that's in units of the fraction of the critical density, which is a fixed number. So only 4% of the critical density in those units can be baryons. If you had more baryons or less baryons, we cannot get the light element abundances. And that is the main reason, main observational reason. So think about it, it's quite interesting. That's the main observational reason why we say that most of the matter that we measure in the universe has to be non-baryonic. Because we know baryons cannot exceed more than 4%. Now you are right, we have a very nice confirmation just recently from the bumps in the power spectrum, in the CMB power spectrum, and that's a beautiful confirmation of that. But again, who knows? If you change the whole model of lambda CDM, there may be another interpretation. I think the Big Bang nucleosynthesis is very difficult to change. There are other more theoretical reasons. That's how we can form structure and so on, and Neil touched upon it. But that's secondary. Those are theoretical arguments, and those we can always change if we need to. We don't know for sure what the right model is. But that's a basic fundamental observation. Okay. So we know that there is non-baryonic dark matter because the baryon limit is only about 4%. And we know it pretty precisely today. What is it? Of course, we don't know. And you'll hear a lot about the possibilities for dark matter. And that is one of the most fundamental questions of the cluster. So just by the amount of distortion, you can measure directly the mass, the potential well of the cluster. So you have three, and we see it in all massive clusters. So you have three independent methods. They all produce masses that are fully in agreement with each other to within the accuracy of the measurement, which is about maybe minus plus minus 20% or so. You cannot measure it extremely accurately, but within the uncertainties and the scatter, they are all consistent with each other. So we know how to weigh those systems. As we go to larger scale in the universe, here is a 3D kind of diagram of the large. Each dot is a galaxy. A cluster is, you know, here is a cluster. This is the redshift direction. This is position on the sky, and it's in a sliced scene. These are the finger of God. Everybody knows what a finger of God effect is? Who does not know what a finger of God effect is? Well, raise your hand, then I'll explain it. If nobody, okay. Finger of God, let me explain, because I think that's a neat thing. This is a cluster, just like the clusters I showed you. This is, in fact, the coma cluster. What you measure in the redshift direction, you measure the velocity. You measure the Hubble expansion. So you measure the velocity of each galaxy, right, the Doppler motion. And you assume that that's a distance based on the Hubble expansion. But those velocities in the clusters, we just said, they move at 1,000 kilometers a second. So that's not part of the Hubble velocity. So if you take its velocity and say, I'll put it at the Hubble distance, you'll be wrong by 1,000 kilometers a second, which is about 10 megaparsecs. So what it will do, it will stretch that cluster. That cluster, if you correct for it, should just be one very dense little round thing. but it's hard to correct exactly for each velocity. So it stretches the all the galaxies, all the hundreds of galaxies, or whatever you measure, in the line of sight, because that's where you measure the velocity. And it looks as if it's a finger of God pointing at you from deep space. So those are the finger of God effects. They are simply the artificial. They show you the velocity dispersion in the cluster. So the bigger the finger of God, the bigger the velocity dispersion. You see many little ones, and there's are smaller groups. The bigger ones are big, massive clusters. That's one way to find the clusters in redshift space. Just a nice terminology. So the question is, how does the mass-to-light function work? We saw what happens in galaxies. As we go to larger scale, the mass keeps increasing. There are big halos. We go to clusters, we see a lot of mass. What happens as we go to larger scale? Does the mass still grow? Do we have much more dark matter as we go to larger scale? And what we found, and that was already in the 90s, we did the mass-to-light function, and we found the mass-to-light function flattens out on large scale. So let me tell you what we plot here. Here is a mass-to-light ratio of various systems. Some of them are average over many as a function of scale. So here are in blue are spiral galaxies. So here are spiral galaxies where it's the luminous matter, 10 kiloparsecs. As you go to larger and larger scale, here is about 100 kiloparsecs, 200. The mass-to-light keeps increasing. I showed you why, because of flat rotation curve. Mass keeps rising linearly with radius. There is no more light. So the mass-to-light keeps rising linearly, and we see that. And it shows that the flat rotation or the halos of galaxies extend to at least 100 or 200 kiloparsecs. Huge, more than 10 times bigger than the luminous core. The same is for elliptical galaxies, except that it's higher by some factor. We understand why. Because the light is less bright in the blue, in the young star. And in red are all kinds of groups of galaxies. And finally, here are rich clusters. And here are some supercluster. And we saw that it flattens out. It gives you something that happens to be about what clusters are. Here is the most recent result we just had from our Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And I'll show it to you, measuring quite accurately by lensing. On these scales, you cannot use any more motions because the systems are obviously not virialized. Clusters is the only place where the system is virialized and you can use velocities. As you go to the supercluster scale of, you know, a few tens, 100 megaparsec, you can only use lensing. Lensing doesn't matter if it's virialized or not. You just measure how much mass is in your way. So on the large scale, we can only use lensing. So we use lensing for the Sloan, for these superclusters, and we get it quite accurately here. I mean, the orbit is pretty small, and you see that it indeed flattens, as we suggested even in the 90s, without this new data point. And when it flattens out, what does it tell you when it flattens out? It tells you a whole bunch of things. First of all, it tells you that you reach the end, the edge of the dark matter. That's the most fundamental thing that it tells you. If it flattens out, remember that mass to light keeps growing if the mass keeps growing over the light. You know how much light there is, but if the mass is more and more, it means you have more and more dark matter, more and more halos. If it flattens out, doesn't mean that there is no dark matter as I go to large scale. The dark matter is there, but it's just as much as light. It just follows the light. It goes together with the light. So you reach the end, the edge of the growth of the dark matter halos. There's no more dark matter halos. They stop someplace around here, left and south. That clear? I think that there are two reasons. That's a detail. I didn't want to get into it. Partly, it's measuring in blue light, and elliptical galaxies are very old galaxies that have much less blue light than spiral galaxies. Blue light is young stars, elliptical galaxies that don't have young stars. That's the main reason. The second reason is that on average, elliptical galaxies are more massive. We think that they come from merging of spiral galaxies and their mass grows from there. But we understand. Any other question about the method or why do we reach the end of dark matter growth?
How are you measuring the mass here?
From lensing. So on the large scale, the only thing, up to clusters, we can use all the method I showed you. Beyond clusters, the only way to do it is lensing. So you need gravitational lensing because there it doesn't depend on what equilibrium state is, and they are not in the real equilibrium. So as you reach to the scales of at least a few hundred kiloparsecs or a megaparsec, there is no additional dark matter. You've finished. We have reached a representative level of this thing, mass to light, for the universe, because we don't expect this to go flat, 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 and then jump up again. No dark matter in the world that I can think of can do that. So that's the first thing that it tells you, that you reach the end. But it also tells you, I showed you, that the mass to light, once you multiply by integrated over the total luminosity density of the universe, if it's representative, gives you omega, and omega matter of 0.2 is right here. That's what you get for me. Omega matter 0.3 is this line. Omega matter 1 is this one. Okay? Yes. It's about a megaparsec, yes. It flattens at about a megaparsec, maybe even a little bit below a megaparsec. And the other thing that it tells you that on this very large, on large scale, they're not so large, but on large scales, there is nothing that separates the mass, which is, now we believe it's mostly this non-baryonic dark matter because the baryons are only 4%. There's nothing that separates the mass, the dark matter mass, or the entire matter, from the baryons themselves. On small scales, it does, because the light is baryonic. So what happens is, the picture, again, you may hear more about the theoretical understanding of it, but the basic picture is, how did galaxies and clusters and all these structures form? They form from dark matter halos in the early universe that collapse at early time by gravity. The baryons follow them because they're both gravity. Just one is baryon, one is non-baryonic. The baryons follow them and fell into those dark matter potential. But because baryons dissipate and dark matter does not, it's collisionless and non-dissipation, the baryons fell into the center. We see this and then cooled and started forming stars, lit up the galaxies. These are the beautiful galaxies we see today in light. But the dark matter, while it's in the center too, it's all around. It did not all fall in while the baryons were dissipated. Now, there are some baryons, some stars, very little in the outer halos. We detect them today, but very little light. But we do see some stars, globular clusters, in the outer halos of our galaxies. So that's the picture, qualitative picture of how the structure forms. So because of dissipation, you can separate the dark matter from the light in that way on small scales. You cannot do that very easily on the very large scale. So it actually fits in quite nicely. We see from simulations, we also use simulations for exactly the same thing, the mass to light versus scale. And you see in the data is the same data, but you see in the bands are results from the simulations for different omega matters, high omega matter and low omega matter. And you see that you see the same flattening on large scale. So while originally in the 80s people thought, well, mass to light keeps increasing until you reach omega matter 1, here we show that no, it keeps rising linearly for a while, but then it flattens out on large scale. And when I showed it to a colleague at that time who has not worked on it, he said, well, that sounds very reasonable because there are no physical processes to separate baryons from dark matter on the very large scale. So that sounds quite reasonable. So what I want you to remember is just that by doing this mass to light function, there were really no assumptions here. We reach the end of the dark matter. We don't assume here lambda CDM, and we don't assume all kinds of things that could change. We just reach the end of the dark matter. We don't see any more dark matter, unless there is some dark matter that doesn't clump at all, but of course then it's not really gravity. So we reach the end, and it gives you a low omega matter of about 0.2 or 0.25. Here are some of our newest results. It's not published yet. That's from lensing from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. We use a huge number of clusters and groups, about 20,000. It's a big survey, covers the entire northern sky. So we have about 20,000 clusters going from those boxes go from very small groups with only three bright galaxies to richer and richer, up to the very richest clusters of very different environment. You measure the mass per unit light within a radius as a function of the radius in the cluster. And you see that in all of them, on the large scale, it flattens out. Here are the rich clusters. You see that even below megaparsec, half a megaparsec, everything is flat. You reach the end. Now, I think, to me, that's just beautiful, because you don't have much assumption. You just flatten out. It means no more halos, no more dark. And if you extend it, and with lensing, we can extend it all the way to large scale. So we extend this lensing all the way to 20 megaparsec scale. So this is measured at 20 megaparsec scale, 22 megaparsec scale. So this is the mass to light measured at 22 megaparsec scale for all these systems. Each one is an average of many as a function of their mass. These are very poor groups, richer, richer, richer clusters. And you see they're all the same. Every place we look, it's the same on that large scale. And that value you can convert to omega matter, as I showed you, gives you this value. So this is sort of the newest result that we have on this method, which is very powerful and tells you that omega matter is very small. And that's one of the methods, how we weigh the universe. Before I go to the next one, any questions on that method or what does it tell us? Okay, so the conclusion on this part is that it tells us it flattens, it tells us that mass follows light on large scale, and it tells us that we reach the end of the dark matter, and it also weighs the whole universe, gives you about 20%, but it also tells you where the dark matter is located. So we know that there is dark matter, we know that it's non-baryonic because it's more than the 0.04, we know how much total it is for the whole universe, we believe. And we know where it's located. Where is it located mostly? Where is the dark matter mostly located? You go back to your university and people ask you, where is the dark matter located? What will you say? It's located mostly in these very dark, huge halos around galaxies going to 200, 300 kiloparsecs. A little more in groups and clusters, but not farther out. Some people said, well, maybe clusters have big halos around them and super. No, it's not there. So it's mostly in those huge halos around galaxies and a little bit more in the clusters, not much more. Okay, fine. Let's move on. If you have any questions later, feel free to ask me. Let me go to the second method and I'll do it briefly. The other method is looking at baryons in clusters of galaxies. In clusters, we can measure how much baryons we see quite easily. What is baryonic in clusters? The stars are baryon, like our own sun, it's baryons. It's, you know, hydrogen and helium and some other elements. So the stars that produce the luminosity are baryonic, and we have this huge amount of gas, hot gas that I did not talk about, but it's huge amount of gas that was discovered, oh, maybe three decades ago from X-ray telescopes in space. That gas, because it's so hot, it emits by thermal Bremsstrahlung, it emits in the X-rays, it's detected, all clusters have it, and you can total up how much mass exists in that gas, which is also baryonic. So you measure what is the total mass of baryons relative to the total mass of the cluster, and the mass of the cluster you get from any of those methods I told you. Total mass, dark matter and baryons. So you measure it in with lensing or with the Virial theorem. And what you find, and if you say that on that scale, within a given radius you measure it, and you say, if you say that on that scale of typically 1 or 2 megaparsec, that ratio of baryons to total, we call it the baryon fraction, is representative of the universe. And I already told you that on that scale, then it will give you omega baryon to omega matter for the cluster, and therefore it's representative for the universe. And I already told you that on those scales, we expect from simulations, from observation, that the baryons and the dark matter is not separated. There's no physical processes to separate it. Unless the dark matter was hot, like neutrinos, then, you know, it will stream out. But certainly not for cold dark matter. There's nothing to separate it. So we expect it to be representative, and simulations show that. So let's assume it's representative. For the gas, we get that this baryon fraction is about 13%. That's how many, out of the total mass of the cluster, how much is in baryons in gas? About 13%. And in stars, even less. So the gas weighs much more than the stars, quite interestingly. And the total is about 16%. Depends a little bit on the Hubble constant, but not much. So we find that the baryon fraction in clusters is about 16%. We know that the total amount of baryons in this unit from BBN and from the microwave background is about 0.04. So you can just plug this number in here and find out what omega matter is right here. So you take this fraction and divide it, and you find that it's about 26%. Is that clear? You can think about it this way. If omega matter was 1, which at that time people thought, what should we have found for the baryon fraction in clusters? What would that number be if omega matter was 1? How many baryons would we find in clusters? If omega matter 1, how much would we find for the fraction? How much? That's what we find. But if omega matter was 1, and we know what omega b is, what would be the fraction?
0.04.
So basically, what we are finding is way too many baryons in clusters. If omega matter was 1, we could not have omega matter 1. And that was done already in the 90s, too. These are more recent values. But there are too many baryons in clusters to be consistent with a high omega matter value. And the only way that that you get from it is an omega matter which is about 0.25. So that's, again, a very simple method. We can look here. That's work that we did a little more recently. The baryon mass fraction in different systems. These are normal galaxies. These are groups. These are clusters. Going as a function of the mass of the system. And we see that the baryon fraction starts in galaxies, it's only about 5%, but it's reaching about this 16% or so on the large system. We still don't understand exactly what happened to all the baryons here around galaxies. We think they've probably been kicked out by supernova, by other things, some heating processes in the galaxies, and the galaxies have much smaller potential. Well, you know, it's only a velocity of 200 kilometers a second, so the gas can get out. Whereas in the clusters, you have a big potential well of 1,000, so it keeps all the baryons. It doesn't flow out very much. And so it's reaching a flattening here, and here is the cosmological value that one obtains from the microwave background fluctuation. They obtain 0.24, I mean, they obtain 0.18, and you see that we are reaching that value. So again, everything seems to fit in quite nicely. So from the baryon fraction, we measure the fraction to be 16% or 18%, depends if we correct by 10% or so. If you plug in the value that you know for baryons, again, you find way too many baryons. If omega matter was high, you get that value, which is nicely consistent with what I showed you from the mass to light function, and nicely consistent with many other measures that I did not show you. So let me just summarize some of the measures. The mass to light function we talked about, that was one of the earliest thing we used. The baryon fraction was also one of the earliest, although all of those are updated with very recent results and give you this very nicely in agreement numbers. Cluster abundance is a beautiful method that I did not discuss here. That we worked on also gives you the same value. The supernova and assuming a flat universe gives you such a value. The recent microwave background, various large scale structure, and assuming flat. Here you have to have many more assumptions with the same, but you don't get just omega matter. You have to assume other things to go with it to get, because there are many parameters to fit that particular, but there are many parameters that go in, whereas in the master light, you just get one parameter. So the CMB, I'll show you, it's beautifully and consistent with this entire model, but you have to assume some other things. So that's roughly the mean value of those things, with only 4% baryons and the rest in non-baryonic dark matter, and the mass follows light on large scales. I can go to show you some of the observational results on dark energy now, unless you're all familiar with that. Everybody familiar with the supernova observational results on dark energy, or shall I show you? You want to see it? Okay. Don't be shy. Say yes. We'd like to see. It's hot in here. I see everybody. Can they turn up the air conditioning? I see everybody is. Yes. There are no silly questions. There are always good questions. Yes. Omega matter?
Yeah.
I'll come to that. I'll show you the CMB fluctuation, I hope, if I have time, and I'll show you. It's not very simple. The only thing that they get very simple is, maybe you ask, the position of the first peak tells you that it's a flat universe. That they get very well. The combination of omega matter and omega baryon and lambda, all of that degenerate with some other things. So, but I'll come to that. Yes. 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 Well, they were wrong. I think it was mixed. And in the beginning, when we first started showing omega matter of about that value, 0.2, 0.25, must have been in the late 80s or so. At that time, inflation came about, and inflation wanted omega matter, well, omega equals one. And at that time, people only thought about omega matter, nobody thought about lambda. So it was a conflict. In fact, if you remember that time, the standard CDM, SCDM, was omega matter equals one in the 80s. I still have plots with SCDM from that time. That was a standard model, because inflation wanted it, not because any observations. Quite amazing psychologically. There was no observation to show omega matter equals one. Inflation wanted that. So I remember giving talks about that. And at the beginning, it was quite, people really did not believe it. And say, well, how can it be, how can you have 0.2, at 0.2, that means you started at the early universe at 0.99. It's a funny number. It's natural to have one, but they couldn't see anything wrong. Many people tried to repeat it and found the same result. As we went along into the 90s, we showed several, we worked on the baryon, mass to light, we worked on the clusters, all showed the same results. People started believing in it. So I would say that many of the astronomers and some physicists started saying, yes, we in fact, probably omega matter is small. We don't understand what's going on, but omega matter looks as if it's small. I remember even giving a talk at MIT, and Alan Goose said, well, we have to start working on open inflation. Because people started seeing, that's the beauty of science. You start looking at the data, and if the data from different directions tells you the same thing, people start believing it. And that's what happened. So people started believing it more and more into the 90s, where we saw different methods. Then, of course, there was maybe a few more. Rocky Cobb, probably never believed it until there was dark energy. But I think many others really believed the data, said, yes, we think omega matter is small. We don't quite understand it, but maybe we need open inflation. Maybe inflation is not right. We need to understand it. So many did start believing it in the 90s. And then at the end of the 90s, 99, came the supernova. Once the supernova came, it went just like that, because you combine this, and I'll show that to you, you combine the supernova results what the supernova measures, and I'll come to that, is a measure really the expansion rate of the universe, which is a combination of omega matter that pulls the universe back in, the expansion, plus anything else that pushes it out, which we now call dark energy. We don't know what it is. So they measure the sum of the two, or the difference, omega matter minus omega lambda. One thing is pulling you in, that gravity, that's what we measure in all the methods I show you, minus something else that's pushing it out. So they measure the omega matter minus omega lambda, and they found it to be a negative number, like minus 0.5. You combine their result with our result for slow omega matter, you get a flat universe, which is exactly the right model. Omega matter of 0.25, omega lambda of 0.75, and together it gave you a flat universe. That was well before the CMB. So the CMB fluctuation, while many people today say, well, that's what tells us. No, they just confirmed that model. And I think it's very powerful because it was a prediction. So that model was a prediction. CMB, once they measure things very accurately, could have found something totally different. But they found the same model, even in the 99, the end of 99, wrote this, I'll show you the cosmic triangle. That was before the CMB. It shows that model. The supernova and this measurement of omega matter gives you exactly the model we see today. Omega 0.25, omega lambda 0.75, and a flat universe. And if we come to it, I'll show you. And I think the beautiful thing is that the CMB, with great detailed observations, confirmed it. So it was a prediction that has been confirmed, which I think is the most beautiful thing of all. So here is the original, some of the original, well, no, that's from 2003. So how did the cosmic acceleration was measured? People have been trying to measure it for decades, to measure what was used to be called the deceleration parameter of the universe. The universe is expanding. Everybody thought, well, the universe expansion must be slowing down, decelerating, because we have gravity in the universe. So gravity, the only thing it could do is slow it down. And it was called the deceleration parameter. So over many decades, people tried to measure it. It was very difficult. Finally, two teams used the supernova, special type of supernova 1A, that I think you're all familiar with that, to measure the expansion rate of the universe. The method is they used supernova as standard candles, the same as Hubble used earlier in the century to measure the expansion of the universe. He used some special type of star called Cepheid variable as a standard candle to measure the expansion of the universe. Everybody knows what a standard candle is? Okay. No? Okay. Standard candle is something, a star or a galaxy or some source of light that you believe you know its intrinsic luminosity. So you know that that particular, all these supernova are 100 light bulbs. If you know the intrinsic luminosity by simply measuring the flux here on Earth, the apparent luminosity or the flux, you measure the distance. It's just the intrinsic luminosity divided by the distance squared. So if you know that it's a standard candle, means you know exactly its intrinsic luminosity because all supernova 1 are of that luminosity, you can calibrate it nearby. By just measuring those supernova at different redshift, measuring the flux, you measure directly the distance to them, not the Hubble distance, but measuring the actual distance to them. Because the Hubble diagram, you don't know how to extrapolate to large distance. That clear? That's what Hubble did. So you measure the distance, that's on one. So you measure actually this is the flux, which is proportional to the distance squared. This is larger flux, so it's more distance. You measure it as a function of redshift or as a function of time. These are very early supernova, redshift one also. That's what Hubble measured. He measured the distance to the Cepheid variable on right here in that little corner as a function of their velocity away from us and found that the universe was expanding. So that's what they do with a supernova. They use a supernova light, they find supernova, they use a supernova light as a standard candle. And we know they calibrated it, it's pretty good standard candle. And they measure the flux so they know the distance and they plot the distance versus redshift, which is the Hubble relation. That's the Hubble expansion of the universe. So here, it's a linear relation. Of course, that's magnitude, so it's not linear. But as you go to very large scale, it starts deviating based on the cosmology. So if the universe was empty, right, you measure the expansion rate of the universe. If the universe was empty, there was no matter, there was no anything, how will the expansion go? The universe will keep expanding at the same speed because you don't have gravity to pull you in, you don't have dark energy to pull you out. So it will go just continue as a straight line. If you have omega matter one, if you had a lot of gravity, what will happen to the distances? What will happen over here if you have a lot of gravity? What will happen to the distances we measure with a supernova? Will they be closer to us, farther away to us? What will happen to the universe if you have a lot of gravity? It contracts. So the distances will be what? Closer to us. That's a way to measure it. So if you have a lot of omega matter, the distances will be on the low. It's a small effect, but the distances will be small to us. If you have a little bit of omega matter, here the middle one is omega matter of 0.25. You see, they used it even at that time. So it was used quite a bit. And no lambda, it will be the middle line. But if it's more distant, farther up here, means the universe is expanding too fast for whatever omega matter is. And that was a discovery of the acceleration of the expansion rate of the universe. You can see it a little bit better here, where this thing is presented just as a difference from a given model. And the given model is the middle model with omega matter of 0.25, which at that time was already accepted with no lambda. Here is omega matter one, and here is where the data was. So that means they see the distances at these larger scales larger than what you expect if you just had a matter of 0.25 and nothing else. Something was accelerating the expansion rate of the universe. That's the data. The whole expansion rate of the universe is based on that. It's big scatter. It took a while for many astronomers to buy that. We thought maybe it was dust that making them fainter and therefore look more distant and so on. But they checked it very well and calibrated very well, and they did a terrific job. Two totally independent competing teams came to the same result, totally independent. Here is the most recent update on that. Again, here is the Hubble diagram. Here you see the difference. Oops, the line broke. But you see that the green is the average. It's big scatter, and that's why I want to show you the result. So sometimes you get extremely fundamental new results from data that looks, you know, not particularly great. It's huge scatter. But this is the mean of all of that. And it shows that it's accelerating. And again, as I said, what they are measuring is the difference. Omega matter, you know, they're measuring the universe as a whole, the expansion. So you have always two forces there. Omega matter that is decelerating you, and something else is pushing you out. So they measure the difference between the two. And it's negative. Negative means they find it accelerating. So that already tells you that lambda has to be bigger than omega matter. So if omega matter is 0.25, omega lambda has to be bigger, it's 0.75. So if you combine that and our measurement, you get exactly the right model that we all talk about today as the lambda CDM, and that was before the CMB measurement. I also want to show you something which I think is very powerful and convincing. This measurement, you see, it gets accelerating and then it turns back. There's a few more points here and it's turning back. So it's turning back where the universe is not accelerating at high redshift. Why is that? They are seeing something that when you go to redshift of one or so, or above one, they don't see the acceleration. They actually see the universe decelerating. They reach to a place where the universe is decelerating. Why? What happens at redshift? Around one or so, high redshift. Why is the universe all of a sudden slowing down, speeding up? What?
Matter domination.
Yeah, we are not yet. Matter domination is way, way, way back there. Matter domination is Oh, you talk matter. Yes, that's exactly right. Just okay. Matter, that's exactly right. What happens is that at earlier time, as you heard from Neil, the mass density increased as A cubed. So the mass density was higher. The dark energy was, well, if it's a cosmological constant, it was smaller. The volume was smaller, it's smaller. Whatever it is, it had to be much smaller, because if we had a lot of dark energy in the early universe, no galaxies would form. It's anti-gravity, the dark energy. It won't let the galaxies form, the stars form, and so on. So at earlier time, even at redshift 1, or even before 1, you start seeing, as you said, the matter domination. So at that point, this value will become positive. So they reach a point where the universe is indeed decelerating, where the matter density is higher than whatever the dark energy was at that time. And that convinced many of us that they are seeing a cosmological effect, that it is cosmology, because that's what you expect from cosmology. So that is, I think, a beautiful confirmation that it is cosmology. So that leads, when you combine, again, even just the supernova and the methods I showed you about measuring omega matter, it gives you to the familiar content of the universe. Here are the baryons. Again, you see only part of it is littered. Some is dark, non-baryonic and dark energy. And of course, that's exactly the same thing that the CMB confirms, which I think is really just quite remarkable that they confirm that model. So these are the peaks that they see. The first peak, and there was a question before, the first peak, the main thing that the location of the first peak at 1 degree, it happens at 1 degree, it tells you about how flat or curved the universe is. I think that's one of the main clean results that you get from it, that is not too degenerate with other parameters. And it does it for the following reason. You know what the sonic horizon was at the time where the CMB was generated. You know it in megaparsecs, about 150 megaparsecs. We measure it now in angle on the sky. So if the universe is flat, we'll measure some angle, 1 degree. If the universe was open, these degrees, the location will be less than 1 degree. It will be like half a degree. If the universe was closed, it will be, you know, the opposite. It will be bigger than 1 degree. And they measure this position at exactly 1 degree. So in a very simple geometrical way, they measure the geometry of space. Now, it's a little bit dependent on some of the parameters, but very, very little. So the flatness is determined to just maybe a couple of percent. That's pretty amazing. The other, you ask how one determines the omega matter and so on. There is not but one particular thing that tells you omega matter. What you do is you look at the ratios. The height of this peak tells you the ratio between omega matter and omega baryon. If omega matter is higher, this peak will be smaller relative to the baryon. They measure omega matter age squared. So it's a bunch of parameters. You could fit some of this with a higher omega matter but very low Hubble constant. But we know how low Hubble constant cannot fit the measurements of it. So the main thing is to remember, this tells you about the flatness. So that's the sum of all omega matter and lambda and so on is 1. All the ratios here tell you about omega matter to omega baryon and so on. Okay? So if we summarize it in what we call the cosmic triangle just tells you, we summarized it as Friedmann equation, omega matter plus lambda plus anything else, plus the curvature is 1. We measured the mass density of about 0.25 going back to a while ago. The dark energy, 0.75 with a supernova and later with the CMB. Just these two alone tells you the space curvature is flat. Again, that's beautifully consistent with the flatness of the peak from the CMB. Well, this just tells you how you get there from Friedmann's equation, but I think you're all familiar with that. So this is the cosmic triangle that we generated in 1999, but with the CMB now included. So you look at omega mass, omega dark energy, and omega curvature. Each point here satisfied Friedmann's equations. Here is still the standard old CDM, CDM of one. So here is omega metal zero, here is omega metal one, here is omega lambda zero. You do it on a diagonal point five. So here is omega metal standard, used to be standard omega metal one. Here is the lambda CDM. You see, you need the lambda, low omega. Here is what we get from the clusters and mass to light ratio. Here is what the supernova gave us. That's where it was in 1999. The CMB now is beautifully consistent with that. So this is what the summary of the cosmic triangle is, that the mass density of the universe is so, and that by itself tells you that the universe will expand forever. Not enough gravity ever in that to stop the expansion of the universe. It tells you that dark universe is so. If it's a cosmological constant, we believe that the universe will keep accelerating forever if it's a cosmological constant. And the space curvature is zero, universe is flat. It just happened that those two give you exactly one. Okay, thank you. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So in the beginning, you mentioned the most fundamental observational reason to believe in dark matter is nucleosynthesis, and that's been around for ages. So have the Mon people come up with a clever way to incorporate that into their epicycles? I mean, they can explain the galaxy rotation curve sure beautifully, but altering the expansion of the universe during nucleosynthesis.
Well, they don't have any argument with nuclear with DBM because they say there's no dark matter. They just have all the baryons to fit DBM, and all these dark matter arguments that I showed you, they just change Newton's law. So you put one more factor of R in the acceleration, and you get rid of all the dark matter. They cannot deal with the gravitational lensing because they don't have a model, and they don't have a GR theory. It's just an ad hoc model. So they cannot deal with the GR. They cannot deal with the fluctuations in the early universe because they need some GR model for that. The fact that the first peak is a flat universe, you know, that you don't even need GR for that. That's there, and what they need, and that makes it really quite ugly, I think, they need a universe that is fully dominated by dark energy, let's say by cosmological constant. So you have 96% cosmological constant and 4% variance. That's their universe. So they cannot answer a lot of those questions because they don't have a GR model. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you consider the cluster and the motion of the galaxies, and there's a dark matter is moving the visible matter, or there is some unmoving concentration of happening.
Everything is moving in the universe. There's not a single thing that stands still. Everything is moving. So in the cluster, the dark matter is gravity. So the dark matter is moving at this the same velocity dispersion of 1,000 kilometers a second. So the dark matter, whatever those particles are moving at that speed. That gives the potential of the cluster. So in fact, the galaxies or the gas are just trace particles. They are small trace particles in this big gravitational potential that is dominated by dark matter. So they are just tracing that potential. They are all moving at that speed of 1,000 kilometers. And that's why it's so nice to be able to measure it, and they all give you consistent results. Yeah.
I have two questions. So why are the rotation curves flat as opposed to just anonymously high? And then the other one was, what's special about a megaparsec? Is it some process or something?
Why the rotation curves are flat? You tell me. I don't know. That just tells you that there is dark, either there is dark matter or there is something like Mond. Now, we heard from Neil before, we don't want anybody but you to work on Mond, and I would agree with that. But we don't. Why is it flat? If you assume Newton gravity, it just tells you that there's a lot of dark matter. So, and we see from I showed you from the simulation. So, if you look at a lambda CDM, and I don't know that the lambda CDM will stay there forever. You know, it may be right, it may not be right. I think the universe, as I described it, that it looks like omega matter of 0.25, omega lambda, that will not change from the observation because the observations are so good now. the interpretation of what is a dark matter, what is dark matter, that may change. You may need to change GRs. At the moment, we don't know. But so the rotation curves are flat, we believe, because there is a lot of dark matter there that grows like R, that the mass continues to grow linearly with R, and we see it from the simulations of the lambda CDM model. So why is it like that? Because we think the heuristic picture of how this structure started is that you had early on, cold dark matter fell to create the potential wells, the baryons fell into that same picture that I said before. The baryons just fell more into the center because of dissipation, cooled, and lit up the stars. They're in the center, and the dark matter is more on the outside. It is nice now, and really makes you feel comfortable. We do see some stars coming all the way to 100 kiloparsecs. So it really is something there. We see stars there. Not many, not much light, but we see some stuff there. So that's why they are flat. Now, we are trying to understand the dark matter properties, but that's why we believe they are flat. What was the other question?
Oh, megaparsec.
Well, I think that relates to that. I think it depends to what the dark matter is doing. If the dark matter is cold, and it's only about 0.2 or 0.25, it stops going at some point, and that's a scale where it stops going, because you don't have any more. If it was a higher omega matter, it may have grown a little bit more. So it just tells you about the fundamental properties of the total omega matter and the fact that the dark matter is cold. If the dark matter was hot, like neutrinos, which was rolled out already a long time ago, it will stream out and you'll get much more dark matter on much larger scale. We don't see that. So it connects to the properties, as Neil said, that it's cold. And the total is only about 0.2.
Nitta, I think maybe another answer would be just a megaparsec is a typical size of a halo. So that's why it enters.
Yeah, but the question is why? Why is a halo a megaparsec? Why doesn't it go to 10 megaparsecs? And that's what people thought. Maybe as you go out of clusters, you still have halos and it goes to superclusters. And it doesn't, because omega matter is low and it's a cold sort of lambda CDM.
But you could also imagine that it has to do with the fact that, you know, 8 megaparsecs is about the scale non-linear.
Yes.
So
yes.
At highly linear regime, then probably the baryons and dark matter at more.
That's right. That's right. So that's another reason to put in there. Yeah. Because we see even for omega 1, we see a flattening in the simulations. It does appear maybe slightly on a larger scale, but not that much.